This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Wednesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. On today's Noon Business Hour, also Personal Finance Wednesday, helping your parents when they are struggling financially. The latest CEO step down involves a suburban pharmaceutical giant. That's in our next segment. Right now, Google is getting into the banking business. Let's get all the details from Gary Kaltbaum, president of Kaltbaum Capital Management, also a Fox News business contributor based in Orlando. His website, GaryK.com. All right, Gary, tell us what you know about Google getting into banking.
Well, Amazon was in talks with J.P. Morgan Chase about a checking account. You have Apple launching a credit card with Goldman Sachs. Uber's trying to push into it. Facebook announced some new system last week to facilitate payments. So here goes Google. When you have hundreds of millions of consumers that use you, you're a captive audience, and we'll see whether this passes muster with the regulatory bodies in Washington, D.C., because I remember a long time in the past to get into the banking industry, it was not easy.
Now, does this just reflect how banking has changed? I mean, it's not like a lot of people even write checks anymore. It's almost a silly name for the types of accounts that people have.
I think I'm the only one who uses hard checks these days. Let's put it that way. Look, the ease of movement now, the ability to move money around, whether it's Venmo or Zelle or all these other things is out there. So I get it. It's just a matter of if it's going to be accepted by regulatory bodies, and I expect over time the answer will be yes, but the calls into question data and what these companies are going to be using with the data, because they do not have a great reputation with privacy and your information. So this will be played out over time, but leave no doubt, now Google is front and center.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it shows, I guess, some of the concerns that regulators may have. I mean, Google says it's not going to sell any of that data, but it's less about that and more about can they keep it all protected?
I'm not so sure about that. But look, just remember, when people sign up with Facebook or Amazon or Google, they're supposed to know what they're signing up for and what's being done with their data. And of course, most people don't check. And then when they get upset when they're being used for things that they didn't expect, that is part of the business and understanding of it. But most important thing is ease of use. And, you know, things continue to change. And Google, with Google Pay, is now trying to – and I suspect, by the way, there's going to be a lot of partnerships. I don't think the J.P. Morgans of the world are just going to hand things over. So I think there's going to be a lot of partnerships. And my expectation is these things are going to move rather quickly over the next year or two.
It'll be fascinating to watch. Thank you, Gary Kaltbaum, president of Kaltbaum Capital Management. Again, his website, GaryK.com. Just ahead, a change at the top coming to Chicago area based Abbott Labs. Abbott Labs chief executive Miles White stepping down effective next year after more than two decades at the helm of the North Suburban headquartered healthcare company. Let's talk about the change with Bruce Japsen, Chicago based healthcare writer for Forbes. You can hear Bruce's reports on health Monday evenings and Saturday mornings here on News Radio. Bruce, before we talk about what Abbott Labs might need going forward, let's just talk about Miles White's tenure here. I'd say in general, a lot of success here for Abbott.
Yeah, Miles and I sort of grew up together in Chicago when I worked for, we'll say, another network. How about that? And back in 1988, 1989, when he became CEO, I mean, he's been CEO a long time, and he has indeed transformed Abbott. I mean, Abbott, he inherited a lot of problems. I mean, they had some issues in their diagnostics division. They had some healthcare fraud payments that they made over the years. But he's transformed this company. And back then, you know, we've seen a lot of companies leave Chicago. And in the drug business, particularly, if you're not producing blockbuster drugs. You know, there was questions of whether Abbott would survive that, and Miles really pulled him through, and they transformed the company. They, you know, bought a drug company, Noel Pharmaceuticals, that had Humira, and then they spun off their drug business into AbbVie, which is Humira. And let's talk a little bit about the numbers, of course. Abbott, when Miles started in the late 90s, Abbott's market cap was worth about $70 billion.
So
today,
go ahead. What are they today?
$150 billion. That's $150 billion. Now let's add in AbbVie, which is, you know, up in Lake Forest. That's worth about $125 billion. And then they sold their hospital products business, Hospira, to Pfizer for $17 billion. So you're talking, he could lay claim, and they are claiming in their press releases, to an executive that added, you know, $250 billion or more market cap in Chicago and the surrounding area and so forth, whereas there are a lot of companies that have left here. And so Miles's legacy for Chicago business is certainly one of success.
So then how do you follow that? Who might follow it, and what would Abbott be looking for? I mean, it's pretty good.
Yeah, well, they basically, you know, they're picking an internal guy, Robert Ford, younger guy. He's an Abbott guy. He's been around. He's been involved in some of their acquisitions that they've made in recent years. And let's face it, he wouldn't be getting the job if Miles didn't like him and elevated him to be the number two a year ago. And, you know, they don't have the blockbuster drugs anymore, but they've remained diversified. They have, their Robert Ross products, nutritional business. They have diagnostics. They have medical devices, heart devices, and they've got the top-selling glucose monitor in Freestyle Libre that I think this year might make over $2 billion in sales. They're on track to be generating about $500 million in sales a quarter. So it's a company that was diversified when he took over 20 years ago. It remains diversified. And if we are headed into some rocky economic times in the next year or so, that usually keeps a company like that protected and so forth. So I think Abbott will be in good hands with the new guys, certainly in the hands they like up there. They usually pick somebody internally, and they have done that over their 130-year history, and I think they're continuing that today.
Good insight, as always. Thank you, Bruce Japsen. You can hear his reports on health Monday evenings and Saturday mornings here on News Radio. Up next, the world's largest Starbucks getting ready to open in Chicago this week. The largest Starbucks in the world set to open Friday on Chicago's Magnificent Mile. Let's talk about this. RJ Hottovy joining us on the Noon Business Hour. RJ is a consumer equity strategist at Morningstar here in Chicago. RJ, if I understand correctly, you have been in what is going to be the world's largest Starbucks. What do you make of this place?
I thought it was a pretty impressive store, to be honest. I think it's something Chicago can be proud of. It reminds me a lot of some of the other roastery locations. So these are the large format locations they have in New York, Seattle, Tokyo, Shanghai, and Milan at this point. But obviously puts its unique spin on for the Chicago market. I think the two things that I was most taken away with was, one is that I think it helps to improve the Starbucks brand image. And then two, I think that they'll be able to take a lot of the products, both beverage and food, and roll them out into Starbucks locations across the country and across the world at some point.
So when a person goes in there, is it just a huge space that sells coffee? There's got to be more going on there.
Yeah, it's always been described, this format's been described many times as effectively the Willy Wonka for coffee, and I think it lives up to that name. You go in there, and each floor, all four floors, have both food and beverage options, and not stuff that you're going to find in your everyday Starbucks, things that are a little bit unique to the store, and it really is the best definition I can think of experiential retail, which I think is what people are looking for in this day and age, to actually go out and see the store and enjoy it. So it's a little bit of everything, you know, a lot of food and beverage options, but just aesthetically, It's pretty unique, both with the coffee roasting and the products that are in there.
Has Starbucks talked about why they're doing this in Chicago? I mean, there's obviously a lot of other places they could have done this.
They did, and they said that Starbucks has always had a unique relationship with the city of Chicago, this being the second market that the company expanded to outside of Seattle. And this has been one of the key markets where we've had a lot of test products from Starbucks, too. So I think that's really the motivation for being here. It's a market they've been in almost longer than anything else, and I think that it does have a special place in Starbucks history.
Let's talk about Starbucks stock for just a moment. Do you have a recommendation?
Yeah, we have a $90 fair value estimate, and shares are trading right around 83.5 right now. Love a little bit more margin of safety, but I do think it's one of the more dynamic growth and income stories in the consumer space, particularly among the large caps at this point.
Thanks so much. Always appreciate you being with us. RJ Hottavy, a consumer equity strategist at Morningstar here in Chicago. Still ahead, Personal Finance Wednesday, helping your parents when they are in a money pinch.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Markets are rallying today. The Noon Business Hour presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Let's see what's going on Wall Street. Mike Larson is joining us, senior analyst at WeissRatings.com, based in Jupiter, Florida. Mike, markets are up slightly today. What are you seeing?
What we're seeing today is this continual drift higher that's been in the market for the last several weeks. It's sort of predicated on the idea, and Chairman Powell has reiterated it today in Congress, that the Fed, they've cut three times, they've cut interest rates three times now, and there's essentially standing pat and sort of forecasting a 1995 or 1998 scenario where the Fed had raised rates, the economy cooled a bit, they cut rates a few times, and that sort of laid the groundwork for a recovery and a big bull run in stocks. So I think people are generally positive about that, as well as looking forward to maybe some kind of resolution on the trade front, as much as the news flow from China or from Trump may change day to day. There's kind of an optimism out there that eventually they're going to sit down, hammer something out, or at least kick the can down the road, for a few more months or quarters.
Does Wall Street at all pay attention to these impeachment hearings, or only if there's some sort of a bombshell?
You know, I think it's really the bombshell question. I mean, the general assumption is that the Senate probably, he still has enough support there from Republicans that'll kind of hold out anything that comes out of the House. So it really would take something shocking, I think, to move this from kind of a political arena to something where the financial markets pay attention and say, geez, this really could impact the outlook for growth going forward.
So the Fed chairman is speaking today. Is that, you touched on the fact that Wall Street's trying to digest this. Actually, good news that he's kind of taken the wait-and-see approach?
Well, I think that, again, the assumption here over the last several weeks, we've sort of seen the script flipped by Wall Street. From the 20 or 21 months after January of 2018, the market had largely been going sideways, and it was the defensive, pre-recessionary type sectors of the market that were leading, meaning things like utilities and REITs were outperforming, banks and transports and the growthier type stuff was underperforming. That has kind of flipped in the last 8 weeks or so on the assumption they'll get a trade deal done, the Fed's cut, but has cut enough, and that will extend this economic cycle. I'm somewhat skeptical, but that is clearly the pattern we've seen for the last couple months now.
Given that flip, what is an investor supposed to do?
I think you don't want to abandon your sort of dividend-paying comfort stocks, for lack of a better word, that have been working so well. Things like utilities and REITs, to me, still offer some value, still offer decent yields, especially when compared against where the U.S. Treasury rates are and so on. You may want to start looking at if this breakout can hold that we've had in the last couple of weeks, if it can hold and or extend, then maybe it's time to add a little bit more risk. But again, I'm somewhat skeptical that's going to happen because I don't think the 95 and 98 scenarios are the most likely here.
Now, some of those dividend stocks obviously were overbought by people who were kind of panicky. In the end, if you're going to hold them for a while and just keep taking that income, does it really matter what they're what they're charging you right now?
No, exactly. I mean, I think with some of those kinds of steady Eddie type dividend focused, less volatile names, I think really you just do have to be patient. I mean, you're going to see these occasional shakeouts, and you've seen it before in the utility and REIT sectors. But essentially, those shakeouts have lasted for at most a couple of months, a few weeks, that kind of time frame. And then the advance has resumed. So I think you're definitely at this point in the economic cycle, those are good places to be as an investor.
Any sectors kind of scaring you these days?
You know, I think certain tech names have really run a long way in a short period of time, things like semiconductors or even a broadly held name like Apple. These companies have really come a long way in a short period of time, and I think that there's probably a breather likely to hit us as we roll into 2020.
And the variety, the flip side, someone says, all right, I'll leave a little money in some of those dividend stocks, but where should I put the rest of this? I'm asking because a lot of people had some cash on the side when they got scared.
Sure. Again, I think that, a sector that's been overlooked for a long time, gold and silver miners, precious metals and so on, they've really perked up starting last summer. They've taken a breather in this last 8-week period. But it looks like after a long period of doing nothing and kind of being ignored by the markets, there's really some opportunities there in terms of being undervalued, in terms of having upside, and sort of the need for precious metals as either chaos insurance or protection against inflation down the road. So that's one sector that I think you can find some opportunities on a pullback.
You feeling good about the forward guidance that we got in general from companies during this earnings season?
You know, there's been a lot of talk that, okay, the earnings have been down on a year-over-year basis, depending how you measure it a little bit here, but the recovery is from that point is underway. Again, I remain defensive and somewhat skeptical unless this market can prove itself. The assumption here is that the Fed has done enough to prevent a recession or a more significant downturn next year. We'll just have to see if that plays out, but I still think caution is probably the best watchword here, just to wait and see if the market can prove it.
Thanks so much, Mike Larson, senior analyst at Weiss Ratings. Up next, Personal Finance Wednesday, strategies for helping your parents when they need money.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday here on the Noon Business Hour, sponsored by Geiger Wealth. Parents can find themselves giving financial help to their adult children. Those roles, though, can sometimes get flipped. Let's discuss giving money to parents. Tony Ogorek is joining us, founder of Ogorek Wealth Management in Buffalo, New York. Tony, good to have you back on the show. So we're talking about what kind of parents here. Are these fixed income parents and kind of inflation and expenses eat up their money? What are you talking about when we're saying helping our parents?
Cisco, I've got 5 bullet points here that I think, regardless of whether you're on a fixed income, still working, whatever the case may be, are things that people ought to be considering. So let's take a look at point one. Sharing financial information between spouses. A lot of times, the wife doesn't know what the husband's got, husband doesn't know what the wife's got. They have no idea what tax bracket they're in, who's got whatever assets, where they are. It's important for both of them to be informed about their financial situation, right?
Yeah. A big part of that is no surprises then down the line, right?
You got it. So all along that same line, make sure each, spouse or partner understands what they have and how it's going to play out in the event of a sudden death. Talk about a surprise. Oftentimes, things can happen and people expect they're going to be living forever. But the fact of the matter is, things do happen, and it's great to know what's happening, especially, in a time of crisis. So I think that's something that's really important.
So then you get it all set up between the couple. Now you got to talk to those parents.
That's it. So now I think it's along the same lines. What you want to be able to do is to share the plans that the parents have come up with their children to avoid any future misunderstandings. A lot of times families can look great until there's money at stake, and then all of a sudden tempers start to flare and relationships get broken. So it's important for the parents to share, this is what our thinking is, so there are no misunderstandings down the road. Really important.
So you talk to the parents. What exactly are you going to be talking about with them? What does that conversation look like?
Well, for example, they may have their estate plan. And they may say, here is that way that's going to play out. And when the two of us are gone, I want you to have this asset, someone else to have something else. I'm going to be dividing assets differently because this child, has a special need. The other one's doing fine. It's important to be able to discuss that stuff ahead of time rather than having a big surprise when there's no one, to give the rationale for why assets are being divided a certain way.
A lot of times in families, you see one, if there's a bunch of siblings, you see one person who's really handling all this. Is it better to try to get others involved?
Well, I think it's important for the, and again, it's not always everyone's thing, and you want to be able to protect against, the perception of self-dealing. So I think it's important for the kids to be able to counsel the parents to be able to come up with these things so that the parents then can communicate it to the kids. But it's the kids' job to make sure the parents, are doing these things. And, along the, a most important thing, oftentimes, if you've got a multi-level house, the house is not safe for the parents. And I think oftentimes kids can counsel them and say, you've been in this house for 30 or 40 years, but guess what? With all the stairs you've got, I don't think it's safe, and maybe you should be looking for a one-floor plan. So I think you know, that's something that's helpful. And finally, the last thing I have is, you know, powers of attorney and healthcare proxies. Your parents really need to have these, and they need to be properly executed, which means there are successors. So let's say, you know, you have the dad and the mom. They get in a car accident, you know, together. They were powers of attorney on each other. Well, now neither of them can act. You need to have a successor, one of the kids or someone else, who can act in their stead, you know, in the event that they're incapacitated for a period of time.
Good insight. Thanks so much. Tony Ogorek, founder of Ogorek Wealth Management in Buffalo, joining us on Personal Finance Wednesday, helping with those conversations about money with parents. This time tomorrow, Technology Thursday. Still to come, a crazy opening day for Disney's new streaming service.
Buy, sell, listen. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Disney Plus, it's already surpassed 10 million signups since its launch yesterday. A debut included some technical issues, though. Let's talk about it with Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and NewMediaSolutions.tv, based in Seattle. Tom, let's begin with those technical issues. What was going on, and is it surprising on a launch day?
You know, it probably isn't surprising in some ways, because when this extraordinary demand that Disney calls it hits your servers, you know, things are going to happen. But by the same token, they are a major media company, so you have to wonder if maybe some of that shouldn't have been anticipated a little bit. As you mentioned, 10 million signups. By way of comparison, Netflix has about 140 million, so a ways to go here, but we're only a couple of days into this. And also remember, too, here that a lot of this is Verizon's free one-year giveaway to unlimited wireless customers. So, yes, free is a good price. That offer is doing what it was intended to do, apparently, to let this service get big and get to do it quickly. But, you know, Cisco, one of the questions, of course, is how many folks are going to convert to being $6.99 per month customers once that trial period is over. So some interesting questions still out there.
And a lot of this really comes down to what it costs Disney to actually operate the streaming service, right? Because they have the content. They're just waiting to be offered.
Exactly. That's one of the big things that they really have in their gas tank is all this content. You know, the content spend is something we've talked about before, and it's crushing. It's, you know, billions of dollars a year. And even with all their content, Disney still plans to spend $1 billion on original stuff in 2020. Right now, they've got up on the service, you know, 500 movies, 7,500 episodes of TV shows, including 30 seasons of The Simpsons, everything from Disney and Pixar and Marvel and Star Wars, and then the new content that they're rolling out too, the first ever live-action Star Wars TV show with The Mandalorian, so lots of expectations there. But yeah, having that big library, definitely an advantage to them on their spend, at least early on.
And that keeps them, I think makes them immediately one of the big players, thinking about these streaming wars that you and I have talked about a lot. At some point, they're going to be winners and losers, and if you have that huge content library, you got to in some capacity be a winner here.
Yeah, absolutely, because you have that asset already in your bank account. You know, that's some of the big questions that we have about this whole industry going forward. The amount of debt, for instance, that Netflix is carrying, what that content is going to be, and how it's compressing margins. You know, right now it is a streaming war, it's a free-for-all. But let's face it, 10 years from now, I'm sure we're going to be in another phase of consolidation where some of the players aren't going to be able to make it. They're going to have to merge and get scale and combine their libraries. Same old story, different platform. But yeah, the business cycle is going to happen here too.
Going to be really interesting to watch. Thank you, Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and NewMediaSolutions.tv.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.